The business of today, which I announced last week, I'm very much looking forward to hearing, which is on horizon scanning, past, present and future. The idea of inviting our speaker to come arose out of a debate we had in the House of Lords on the Intelligence and Security Committee's report last year. And our speaker contributed in a very constructive way by saying that the one thing he hadn't looked at was horizon scanning, and gave us a very good reason as to why he thought we should be looking at it. And I found him absolutely fascinating on that occasion, and I suggested to Jacqueline that we invited him. Our speaker, Peter Hennessy, is an English historian of government. Since 1992, he's been Attlee Professor of Contemporary British History at Queen Mary University of London. And before that, he was a journalist with spells on the Times as a leader writer and Whitehall correspondent, and on the Financial Times and The Economist. So he's had wide academic and journalistic interests. In 2008, he won the Times Higher Education's Lifetime Achievement Award, and in October 2010, the House of Lords Appointments Commission announced he was to be appointed a non-political crossbench peer. He's a member of the Chief of the Defence Staff Strategic Advisory Panel. He's the author of several books, including Cabinets and the Bomb and the Secret State, and another more recent one, which I'll let him tell you what it is. That is what we're looking at today. But I'm delighted to invite Peter Hennessy to address us.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure and an honour to be here. You may have noticed a look of relief on Michael's face, actually, as I got to the lectern, because the last time we appeared together on the boards was any questions in the Midlands. And Michael arrived just in time, and I could see he was in need of water. So I do have some water, Michael. And I managed to spill the water, not just on his left thigh in considerable quantities, but nearly knocked out the electrics of the entire any questions with 3 minutes to go. But he's such a natural gentleman. He was charming about it at the time and has forgiven me since. But anyway, we've just held it together today, which is quite something. Being a university teacher, I always like to start with a little cascade of quotes. My first one on this theme, which really is the defence of the utility of the horizon scanning craft, is from Louis Pasteur. And Louis Pasteur said, "Chance favours the prepared mind." And the other one is from a favourite author of mine, John Buchan of the 39 Steps. And he wrote this in his memoir in 1940. "In the cycle in which we travel, we can only see a fraction of the curve." And I always use that as a justification for the historian's trade, because we have to get the curve as far as we've travelled it, as sorted out as we possibly can. But I need to warn you, actually, that as a historian, I have enough trouble trying to put patterns on the past without distorting it. And I'm absolutely hopeless at looking at the future. I have a truly lamentable record as a forecaster. So anything I say that is tomorrow and beyond, discount entirely just to be safe. Perhaps take 10% of it. I peaked as a forecaster in January 1957, when I was 9, because I was certain that Harold Macmillan, not Rad Butler, would succeed Anthony Eden. And this before the Conservatives got round to having votes on that sort of thing. And I probably believe that because the Daily Express told me to. But I did peak as a forecaster in 1957, so I actually must be candid with you about that. But I've always had a fascination for this world. I think it's built into many historians. It's what the great French historian of medieval Europe, Fernand Braudel, called the thin wisps of tomorrow that are just discernible today. There's almost a human compulsion to try and grab hold of those. As many of you will know, some of you I think are from the bits of Whitehall concerned, horizon scanning is a faintly hot topic in Whitehall at the moment. A year ago, the Coalition published a civil service reform white paper. It is utterly, utterly boring. It is a language which is out of management consulting through Blue Peter, you know, sort of exhortation and management bollocks. It is a life-diminishing read. But there was, in one paragraph, a plan announced to have a review of horizon scanning to see if the multiple efforts at horizon scanning across Whitehall could be brought together more effectively. And indeed, there was such a report, and it was completed in October last year, and we got it declassified just in time for the debate in Hogwarts in the House of Lords on the ISC report that Michael referred to. And it's all to the good. It's a way of making more maximum, using to more maximum effect what has already gone on for a long time in Whitehall. I've been keen on this for a long time, that this should happen, because as an outsider who's interested in Whitehall, I occasionally come across bits of the product that are declassified. For example, I'm a great fan of the Shrivenham, of the Defence Academy at Shrivenham, of the DCDC, the Defence Concept Doctrine and Development Centre, I think it's called. And in the run-up to each Strategic Defence and Security Review, they produce a 40-year forward look of global trends, which I think, I always learn an enormous amount from that. It's carefully caveated, of course, classically crafted without overdoing it. But the press takes no notice. And as a friend of the DCDC, I suggested at a seminar a few months ago that in the one they'll have ready for the 2015 Strategic Defence and Security Review, to get it taken any notice of it at all, is to put a very, very high classification on it, preferably with a strap line, and to leave it on a towpath in the traditional manner, so that a journalist can pick it up. And then the press will take an interest in it. But it was remarkably good stuff, and I commend it to you if you don't know about the product already. The other thing that I've been keen on is a historical treatment of Whitehall's attempts over the last 100 years plus to Horizons Gap. The first one was literally the notion of forecasting that most people have a sense of, which is weather forecasting. Captain Fitzroy in 1854 persuaded the government that the Navy needed weather reports, and indeed he is immortalised in the International Waters forecast, the area of Fitzroy, which I think is somewhere off northwest Spain. But it didn't really begin until just over 100 years ago, when Arthur Balfour, probably the cleverest Prime Minister in terms of little grey cells we've had for quite a long time, which isn't being too unkind to the others, because Arthur Balfour was quite extraordinary, set up the Committee of Imperial Defence in 1902 as an experiment. Now, the Committee of Imperial Defence we would now call a National Security Council. And indeed, Mr Cameron's invention of the National Security Council is, roughly speaking, the Committee of Imperial Defence with rather better IT. And, of course, you couldn't rename it that, because it would, of course, would have been misunderstood abroad, wouldn't it? But it is essentially the CID. And the CID was amazingly productive. Not only did it worry about the threats, which are the Russian threat to India, which was very soon superseded as the number one anxiety by the Kaiser's arms race with the dreadnoughts and so on. And it was bipartisan in the sense that the Liberal government, when it came in, Campbell Bannerman and then Mr Asquith, invited Balfour back to sit on the CID as a Privy Councillor, because he was inside the ring of confidentiality, because he'd sworn the Privy Councillor's oath of confidentiality. And the most famous thing it did in the run-up to World War I was to create a Secret Service Bureau in 1909, which split in 1911, as you will know, many of you, into what is now MI5 and the Secret Intelligence Service. But also it began the practice of war books. I read the first ever war book recently in the National Archives. It was commissioned in 1912 and circulated in 1913, but of course never published. Germany wasn't mentioned in it, but of course that's what it was all about. It was all about in case of a war with a certain European power. I love those euphemisms. Like in the Cold War, when some of you did those transition to war exercises, the Soviet Union was always orange, wasn't it? And NATO was blue, if I remember, or green. Anyway, I digress. But the first war book set a tradition and a pattern which runs right through now to today. My research students and I, in recent years, have been examining the transition to World War III war books, which were declassified long after the Cold War ended for understandable reasons, and they're absolutely extraordinary things to read. Partly because they're based on novels written in the Cabinet Office and the Home Office on the scene changing to one of peril. A change of regime in Moscow to a bunch of adventurers who try it on, escalation takes over, and they always ended up with RR, nuclear release hour. And they write the stories, they write about internal subversion, the nature of the war, the conventional phase, and so on. And they're the best novels that have ever been written in Whitehall. And they used to do them every 2 years. So that tradition runs on. In 1919, after the Great War, with the Bolshevik Revolution worrying the guardians of national security quite a lot, David Lloyd George, over there, his bust, he commissioned a study which led to the creation of the Supply and Transport Organisation, which mutated through the Emergencies Organisation after World War II into what we now know as the Civil Contingencies Secretariat. And this was to find ways of mitigating strikes that struck at the essentials of life. The 1920 Emergency Powers Act was the underpinning for all of that. And out of the Committee of Imperial Defence again was sprung in 1923 the Chiefs of Staff Committee, which still meets every Monday afternoon, I think, and with it a backup staff, became its planning staff later, which also did horizon scanning in addition to the intelligence world. And in 1936, the Committee of Imperial Defence again spun out the Joint Intelligence Committee, all source analysis. But the Joint Intelligence Committee didn't really hit its stride until World War II because the service intelligence departments didn't like it and starved it of material. But when Winston Churchill became Prime Minister, the Joint Intelligence Committee and its backup became the main all-source analysis suppliers of his voracious appetite for intelligence. But it wasn't always on the politico-military side, the expression of the British urge to horizon scan, which is deep within us. For example, in November 1942, William Beveridge produced a plan for post-war welfare and full employment. Now, this was an accident because Beveridge was almost impossible to work with. In fact, he was impossible to work with. And the great Ernest Bevin, Minister of Labour and National Service, couldn't bear him anywhere near him in the Ministry of Labour. So he said, find him something from which he'll never reappear. And there are certain Bermuda triangles in British politics and government, one of which is House of Lords reform, for example. Every generation, people disappear into the Bermuda Triangle. Some never come out. Others come out singed round the edges, bemused and dazed and vowing one thing, never to return. That's Lords reform. We've had a lot of trouble with that lately. But the national insurance is another Bermuda Triangle. Welfare, overlaps, all that. So Beveridge was given a small team to work with him from across Whitehall, in the expectation Ernie Bevin would never see him again and nobody would hear from him. But being William Beveridge, he turned it into a manifesto, was a genius for publicity. And he wrote it in the usual porridgey way that welfare documents are written. But Jessie Mayer, who later became his wife, said to him, William, nobody will read this. You've got to strike a Cromwellian tone. So he decided he would. And it sentences like, a revolutionary era is a time for revolutions, not for patching. There are five giants on the road to reconstruction. Ignorance, idleness, squalor, disease, want. Cromwell, Bunyan. Just imagine if Ian Duncan Smith produced a white paper like that now. He would be at the very least offered counselling. But it sold 750,000 copies, and it made the political weather. And it was a horizon scan, because his argument was, unless you struck those five giants, all of them simultaneously, the crust of deprivation would not be broken. And without full employment, you wouldn't be able to afford the welfare and the health service and all the rest of it. And without free secondary education for all, you would never get the transformation in productivity that you needed. And it was an integrated plan and a long forward look with a lot of actuarial stuff in it that has never been replicated since. We do it in little penny packets now, which is a great mistake. But that was a remarkable horizon scan. And Attlee, the big idea of Mr. Attlee's Labour government after all was planning. They'd seen planning being very effective in World War II on the home front and on the military front. And they set up a central economic planning staff but didn't really know what to do with it. And it used to take snapshots of what had happened in the previous year and be full of Stafford Cripps-like exhortations to work harder in the forward look. Never really took off. But again, it tried to do its horizon scans of where the British economy might be going and where the bottlenecks were. And in 1948, the pound sterling being ever shaky, the Treasury adopted their own version of all this with the Sterling War Book, they called it. And it was all ready to go for the devaluation, which duly came in 1949. Now, the post-war period was quite productive in changing the nature of horizon scanning. Of course, the Cold War concentrated people's minds. That was where the bulk of it was done, for obvious reasons. And the Cold War secret state we constructed bit by bit over the 40 years of the Great Confrontation reflected that. But in 1957, these institutional changes can make a big difference. The Joint Intelligence Committee and its backup moved from the Chiefs of Staff Committee to the Cabinet Office so it could do not just defence planning in the main, politico-military, but wider political analysis too, after the Suez Crisis, in which British intelligence had warned Anthony Eden, the most remarkably prescient Joint Intelligence Committee assessment of August, early August 56, which tells him what the outcome will be if he tries to go it alone with the French without American backup. Fascinating. Took no notice of it. But the Joint Intelligence Committee is brought into the Cabinet Office and becomes the recognisable body that we know today. The best forward look I've ever seen in the post-war years, because I can only see it when it's declassified after 30 years, not being an insider, was something Harold Macmillan commissioned in immense secrecy in June 1959, in the run-up to what was the smuggest post-war British general election until the Blair years, the never-had-it-so-good general election. Because Macmillan, being a scholar and an anxious and thoughtful man, in private, was very worried, not just about the Cold War, which he was hypersensitive to it, or everything ending in a great thermonuclear blast one afternoon, but also about Britain's place in the world and our economic underperformance. So he commissioned the chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee to do a study of where we would be by 1970 on current policies, and to spare them nothing. And they got the brightest people from the military, the intelligence world, the domestic and the foreign departments, and the defence ministries, the service ministries as they then were. And it was so candid that he pulled it from full cabinet discussion in February 1960 and took it into a small cabinet committee. And when one reads it, it's beautifully written, unlike the management consultees that we get now, beautifully written, and spared them nothing. And the only thing it got seriously wrong was it said there's no likely to be a recrudescence of troubles in Northern Ireland. But most people would have said that in 59 to 60, so I'm not criticising them. And I've been keen that Whitehall should do it again, a horizon scan like that across the piece, for a long time. But every time I suggest it, I'm told, no, you couldn't do that because it would leak. And also, it would be under the Freedom of Information Act. So you couldn't produce the levels of candour that Macmillan got, which is a terrible reflection on one aspect of freedom of information. I'm an open government person, really. But if it means, unless they're using it as an alibi, I don't think they are, the fear of leaks mean that speaking truth under power, which is the prime purpose of Crown servants under our system, in uniform or not, is much diminished. Foreign Office sets up the planning staff in 64, which does remarkably good things, and still exists under another name. And in 1968, the Cabinet Office creates an assessment staff to back up the Joint Intelligence Committee more effectively. Ted Heath, who's a much underestimated man, very difficult man, he sort of produced ripples of unease around him, wherever he was. And as somebody once said, he would do a famous Easter Island statue in the House of Commons, all this sort of stiffness, you know. But he was a very interesting man. And he set up the Central Policy Review staff, his think tank in the Cabinet Office, quite small, to do quite a bit of horizon scanning. And the great Victor Rothschild was recruited, chief scientist from Shell. And he was an extraordinary man to do it. And he set up for ministers an early warning system. Because Willie Whitelaw, who's a lovely man, had a little outburst after an insurance company collapsed in 71, Vehicle and General. Why is it I learn about cataclysms in my bath? Why are we never given any warning? So to cheer up Willie Whitelaw, they created the early warning system. But they fell into the trap that very often happens to horizon scanners, is the stuff was so sensitive, particularly if you were candid, that Ted Heath said it has to be kept to a very small number of people. It can't even go to the full cabinet, so it becomes self-defeating. There are other problems with it, which I'll come to in a minute. More recently, we've had foresight in BIS department, fusion, and the Joint Terrorism Analysis Centre. There's all sorts of good things being done. But there are perpetual problems with it. Now, the attempt to bring it all together, I'm sure, will bear fruit. But fragmentation is always a besetting problem. Also, the difficulty of talking about friend-to-friend intelligence, you see, which we don't do, of course. And the problem was, in the cataclysm, the financial cataclysm of 2008, we had a seminar on this. Richard Mottram, who was chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee at the time, said if the Joint Intelligence Committee had prepared a paper on derivatives, it would not have been welcome. Partly because the people we're bothered about are our own people and our allies, you see. So the intelligence world has always been rather hobbled by that. Well, Her Majesty the Queen's question at London School of Economics, if this was so big, why did nobody foresee it? I chaired a couple of British Academy sessions answering her question, which were delivered down to the other end of the mall. And I suggested, cheeky really, shouldn't have done it, or we suggested, that she should bring together, this is before this recent initiative, all the horizon scanning that's done in Whitehall by asking for a quarterly report drawing together all the horizon scanning available in her Crown services. And if she asked the Cabinet Secretary for it, they'd have to give it to her, wouldn't they? But the Queen is very sensible about these sorts of things, and the idea was not taken up. The other problem is a human one. Ministers don't like the product of a rise in scanning. I'm very fond of politicians, I really am, and they're absolutely indispensable, but quite a lot of them have to tell themselves fairy stories. It's the great cosmologist Carl Sagan, as the 10th said about that humans have a tendency to mistake hopes for facts, which is the besetting sin of the political class, and not just them. But the problem is, if you get endless warnings about what might happen, it lowers you. You have to believe that because you're there and your colleagues are there, the great intractables have become malleable. Otherwise, you wouldn't get out of bed on a wet Monday in February. So if you're in the horizon scanning craft, there's a kind of luring effect, you know, when the report is coming from some group, oh, not again. What are they going to chill our flesh about this time, you see? And also, mercifully, some of the worst possibilities never occur. And so they can always say, ah, they warned us about this years ago and we're still here and so on. Tamiflu, whatever it's called. No, it's not a blues singer. It's the flu virus stuff, isn't it? Tamiflu and all that's the latest one of that. So the customers don't like it, which is a problem. And if you look on the Cabinet Office website for this horizon scanning review last October, it's very candid. It says ministers are very short-termist. They're not really interested in this. Therefore, it is the duty of the civil service to fill that gap. And it's all there in this report. And indeed, the Cabinet Secretary chairs quarterly meetings to bring it all together, and the Chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee chairs the regular meetings more frequently at a slightly lower level. It's very good for Whitehall, and I hope as much of the product can be released to Parliament and the public as possible, because it will be very good for us. The one bit where I would be critical of the Coalition, I think the National Security Council is an entirely good thing. It's changed the rhythm of tasking of the intelligence world, for example. And it's the first time we've tried to bring the entire spectrum of British defence together, British defence and diplomacy, from the first line of defence, which is the SIS people in the field and the Royal Navy submarines that go into extraordinary places and do remarkable things and bring back home stunning material, to the very last line, which is the Vanguard-class Trident submarine out there in the North Atlantic as we meet, with everything in between, politico, military, trade and aid, soft power, all that. And I'm a great fan of the NSC. But where I would criticise the Coalition was a decision it took at the turn of the year that there shall be no contingency planning for Scottish separation. Well, that's absurd. Alan West has given eloquent evidence to this, to the select committees on the defence side. And the reason, as I understand it, is if we do it, it will leak that we're doing it, and Alex Salmond will say, look, it's viable, they're getting ready for it. And to allow yourself to be mesmerised by, admittedly, a remarkable politician is a huge own goal. You've got to plan seriously. Isn't it funny how a couple of, three politicians can so make the weather? Alex Salmond, obviously. Boris. Would Boris be bothering us if he was called Eric and had brown hair? It's just a thought. I've often wondered about that. Nigel Farage, see, and the sort of terrible effects of the seepage into the cabinet room of all these. But not to do contingency planning strikes me as bonkers. It really does. But there again, that's a personal view. When you think about it, poor old Britain, there's more uncertainty on us in peacetime than ever in any of our collective memory, because of the possibility of Scottish separation, the configuration of the Isles, and us being reduced to our UK, isn't that poetic? The remainder of UK. We ought to have a competition of what we'd be called if it's Northern Ireland, Wales and us. The improbable kingdom is my entry. Our UK is no poetry in it. But also the question of the European referendum. So there's more uncertainty in our geopolitical configurations as well as our physical configurations than at any time in my lifetime, but that's another point. On your seat is a little threats diagram. A few years ago, I was getting ready, it's come out in paperback the other day, a book called Distilling the Frenzy, Writing the History of One's Own Times. And I have a little crack at this theme in a chapter called The Thin Wisps of Tomorrow. And a friend of mine, who's on the Joint National Security Strategy Select Committee of the two houses, asked Alan Judd, we're all mutual friends, and I, to drop what we thought the threats might be to the UK. I mean, not remotely are some of them likely to happen, but to do the whole lot as we could see it, internal and external, though internal and external are very much muddied these days compared to the era in which some of us grew up. And this is what we came up with a couple of years ago. One happened as if on cue, which was the summer riots of 2 years ago. But mercifully, the rest hasn't happened. But I thought I would bring it with me today and show it to you, because the collective wisdom in this room is palpable, and you've got bags of experience between us. We've got huge amounts of experience. And I'd be interested, if not now, well, we can always be in touch, about what you think is wrong with this or what's missing from it. But this was an attempt to have a look at some of the things that might be threatening us in the near to medium term, or indeed the long term. And we didn't do it to chill the bones of the civilian population. It's just as a kind of antidote to Pollyannaism. But everything's going to be terrific. And I do hope, and I'll finish with this, that the next Strategic Defence and Security Review and National Security Strategy will be rather better. I'm not criticising those who did it, because they had to do it at great speed against a terrible financial backdrop, and it was essentially the Strategic Defence and Security Review, five desperate spending reviews with a thin pattern of strategy. But the one bit we mustn't do again, and I say this out of with respect to the people who do it and deep affection for our country, is we mustn't have a National Security Strategy white paper next time, which the only memorable line in it is this one: the National Security Council has decided there shall be no shrinkage in Britain's influence in the world. And the very next day, the SDSR takes away several of those instruments of our... That is self-delusion on a heroic scale. And it's a mantra you hear all the time. And the Ministry of Defence has to produce papers as if that were true. And if you build in self-delusion like that, it's a huge own goal. And it is the only memorable sentence in the whole thing. I mean, between us, can we remember any other line in the National Security Strategy 2010? I don't think so. It is not settable to music. So I respectfully suggest to those who are here from that world that it's done slightly differently next time. I also think, though I'm no judge of public opinion and I'm not a politician, that the British people are very realistic about the world and the condition in which we find ourselves, and that they might actually prefer it if they were spared nothing, as was the tradition in World War II, right through it, rather than be given delusory siren songs from a political class who should know better. I've broken my own rule. I did not come here today to preach, but I've ended up doing exactly that. But it's lovely to see you. I'm very grateful to have been invited.